Blog Talk Radio.
Right about now, the Funk Soul Brother. Check it out now, the Funk Soul Brother. Right about now, the Funk Soul Brother. Check it out now, the Funk Soul Brother. Right about now, the Funk Soul Brother. Check it out now, the Funk Soul Brother. Right about now, the Funk Soul Brother. Right about now.
Good evening, good evening, good evening. It is February 8th, 2021, 8 o'clock on the East Coast. Coming to you live from southeastern North Kakilaki on the outskirts of a military base that was named after a Confederate general. This is the Aunt Canary Experience. I'm your host, Aunt Canary, and I'll be with you for the next 55 minutes. Talking about Black history. So you don't need to call in tonight. This will be a history lesson, I guess. Probably do the same thing next week. into more black historical facts. I've been doing black history programs for this program. I've been doing this going on. This year will be 6 years. And so I've been trying to throw in some black history every year. A lot of these facts, a lot of people don't know about, you know, what we've done in the world and in this country. The thing about it is when people, not every black person, but a lot of black people, whenever you say black history, one of the first things they think about is slavery, which is not always the case. Black people have been doing a lot of stuff, in this world forever. It has been said that mankind started in Africa, but when you got a certain persuasion of people in charge, they don't want to let that information get out. So in order for us to understand our history, we have to do certain things to make sure our people know about what really happened. This is kind of like the episode of Good Times, which is one of the shows I can watch Good Times. I can watch Good Times episodes only up to the episode where James Evans is on. Once they kill him off the show, I can't watch it. And I'm sure I'm not the only person like that. But they did an episode where Michael, the younger son, got in trouble at school because of something he said. He went to the library and got a black history book to learn about his black history because the schools weren't teaching it. And that is true. I remember when I was in school, I could always tell that school was about to get out because in the history books, we would get to that little thin chapter about black people, and it was toward the end of the book. And whenever we got to the end of the book, I could always tell that we had about a month left of school. And then in February, they did a little bit of talking, and that was about it. Because before we got Black History Month, we should just have Black History Week. But they gave us the shortest month to do this in. So we just have to make do with what we got. And I had planned on my Facebook page. I call it Facebook because it's fake. But on my Facebook page, on my personal Facebook page, and on the Initial Radio Network Facebook page, and on the Aunt Canary Experience Facebook page, I had planned on putting up a lot of posts about black history, pictures, and famous black people and stuff like that. But I can't. Not in February, because I have been put in Facebook jail for another 30 days when I had just got off of Facebook jail for 30 days for some bullshit. And then they turn around and put me back in Facebook jail for some more bullshit. That's why I wish somebody would bring back Black Planet. Or I wish somebody would come around and make a social network platform for black folks, because Facebook is just getting, as Eddie Murphy would say, Facebook is getting motherfucking ridiculous. I had just served 30 days because I told a Trump clown, after going back and forth with his asshat all day long, I just got tired of it. So I just said two words to him. I just said, bitch, bye. That's all I said. I typed in, bitch, bye. And do you know, I got 30 days for saying bitch bye, that the word bitch is all over Facebook and nobody gets in trouble for it. I guess I'm the only one. I must be on a watch. I think I'm on a watch list. I think they should, the FBI, Facebook Bureau of Investigation. So those clowns gave me 30 days because I told an asshat, bitch, bye. That's all I said. Didn't threaten to kill him. Didn't threaten to blow up his house. None of that. I just said, bitch, bye. And they gave me 30 days. Fine. I mean, this is what, like the seventh or eighth time they done put me out, which I don't care. I've been around before Fakebook got here, and I'll be around when Fakebook is a distant memory. So I get off Fakebook. I get out of Fakebook jail. They put me on Fakebook probation. Then turn around the same day I get out, they put me right back in again. Why? Because a Trump fan decided to get on Fakebook and spew bullshit. And I don't like a lot of bullshit. So I just simply told the clown, and my words were, I think, to the effect, clown, either prove this or shut the hell up. And I got 30 days for that. Didn't threaten to blow up his house. Didn't threaten to shoot him. All I said was, basically, prove what you just typed or shut the hell up. And that's all I said. So then when I go to appeal about what I just said, nah, you good. You got 30 days. So I've said it before and I'll say it again. Facebook, whatever you want to call it, is a piece of shit. They will let Trump people and stupid people like that, QAnon and all those types of assholes, get on there and spread bullshit all day long, 7 days a week, and nobody says a word to them. But when somebody calls them out, they get them and don't say nothing to the clowns or spewing all this bullshit. That's why we need an alternative. And I guarantee you I'm going to start looking for one. Because this shit's getting ridiculous. It's getting ridiculous. So I had to make up another, matter of fact, I used Luke Cage and used a picture of Luke Cage because I was told not to use my own picture. So now I will be operating for the next 30 days under going underground using Luke Cage as an alias. So if you want to join me, just look up Luke Cage and you will see a picture of Luke Cage. That's probably going to be me. And I think Fakebook is straight up bullshit. And I'll probably get in trouble when I get off again next month. I think, well, I talked to my sister yesterday. I think what I'll have to probably end up doing is just going to post pictures of cats and just post pictures of people cooking fish, I guess. But they might try to stifle what I say, but they're not going to kill the spirit. So fuck them. I'll be back in 30 days. But in the meantime, I'll just use Luke Cage as a underground ID, whatever you want to call it. So Fakebook is bullshit. Somebody bring back Black Planet or something else. Anyway, we're going to get into, I've got two clips, and I think they're pretty good clips. Now, the first clip is a 30-minute clip, and there's a lady. It takes place. Now, this was done in 2018. This was done in 2018. So this lady in this clip talks about Black history. The whole clip is about Black history facts. You may know some of them. Some you may not know. What I try to do is find clips of stuff that happened that, you know, you may not have know about. And I think the one good thing about this is people are starting to, I've said this before and I'll say it again, I think the one biggest problem our people have is that a lot of our people don't like to read. You got to read. If you're going to know anything, you've got to pick up a book. You've got to start reading. It ain't a matter if you like to read. It's a matter if you need to start reading if you don't read, because that's the only way you're going to know what's going on. You got to read about it. So this first clip, this lady talks about different things, different facts in Black history. And now in the second clip, there's a man talking, and he talks about why he, you know, and I think this is important too, why we should not whitewash Black history. and we need Black history because, you know, it's important to our people. You know, we can't let them take over our history. That's why a lot of people think that Black history started with slavery. No. Our history started way before slavery. And that's important for us to know. That's important for us to tell the children. Got to tell our kids. I've got grandkids. And when they get old enough to understand what's happening, I'm going to tell them. I'm going to teach them. Because I know the schools aren't going to teach them. We got stuff right now going on in this country where, you know, people seem to still in the same mindset that we shouldn't be talking about Black history. That's just stupid. So I'm going to play this clip, and I'll play the next clip, and then that'll be pretty much the end of the show. Like I said, no phone calls. All you got to do is just sit back and listen. Hopefully these clips will enlighten you, you know, maybe tell you something that you didn't know. And then maybe, you know, I'm thinking about, depending on what my schedule looks like, next week I'll do the same thing. I'll try to find some clips on more Black history. You know, we only got, what, 3 more weeks left in the month. So I'm going to try to do my best presenting information about Black history that you may or may not know about. So, I mean, that's what I'm here for. So we're going to play this, and I'll probably be in join you in the middle when this clip ends, and I'll play the next clip, and then that'll be it. So listen and learn something.
Greetings, fam. I was praying about what to talk to you about next, and I realized that many, many, many people are in the dark about aspects of Black history that have not been revealed, things that have either been pushed under the rug or hidden. Of course, we all know about Dr. Martin Luther King, but it's so amazing how years later, they managed to pull up some dirt on him. And so now we know even more than we actually need to know. And then we have this new administration, and there is a lot of issues going on there that would take us away from our history, and especially with the advent of Black History Month. I personally feel like there shouldn't just be a month. Black history should be, you know, a no-brainer. So I wanted to give you some things that were, for the most part, not well-known in Black history. You probably didn't learn these things in school, and you probably are going to be surprised at a lot of them. And then there'll be some of you who have knowledge of some of these things, but not all of them. And then there will be the occasional few that have knowledge of everything that I'm about to tell you. So I want to start off with Maggie Lena Walker. In 1903, Miss Walker founded a penny savings bank for the Order of St. Luke, and she served as president. Its goal was to encourage savings and facilitate loans to community members. By 1920, the bank had helped about 600 families purchase homes. Eventually, the Penny Savings Banks absorbed all other Black-owned banks in Richmond and changed its name to Consolidated Bank and Trust Company, and that was in 1929. Then Walker became chairman of the board. Now, what's interesting to note is that Miss Walker, not only was she the first African-American bank president, but she was also the first woman to hold such a position. So, combined with those two facts, this is very noteworthy. And I was surprised because here I am, almost 63. I'll be 63 this year. And I did not know this. I was never taught about it. I never heard about it. No one ever mentioned it. So I was very surprised. A lot of us know Sister Harriet Tubman, who I even have books on her because I read them frequently because her story is so amazing, how she was able to free so many slaves. And one of my favorite quotes by her is, "I could have freed so many more if only they knew there were slaves. If only they knew they were slaves." And that's Miss Tubman in her later years. in a wonderful, beautiful, magnificent photograph. Many of you know of the singer-actress Eartha Kitt, but how many of you know that she was the product of a rape? She was born on a cotton plantation, she spoke 5 languages, and she sang in 7 languages. She recorded the hit song Santa Baby in July of 1953. This little girl was the richest black girl in the world, and it's a shame that barely any of us knew her name. Now, Sarah Rector, by the age of 10, she became the richest black child in America. She received a land grant from the Creek Nation as part of reparations. Soon after, oil was discovered on her property. By 1912, the revenue from this oil was $371,000 per year, which is roughly $6.5 million today. Remember, this is in like the early 1900s. So despite various attempts to steal her land and her fortune, Sarah resisted. She went on to attend Tuskegee University and eventually settled in Kansas City, Missouri, where her mansion still stands. Some of you older folks might recall these young ladies. They were the Fultz quadruplets, and they were the first surviving identical African-American quadruplets. Now, the interesting thing about them is that when they were born, there was a big fuss made about them, and the company who makes the pet milk company, it was actually a few of the companies that approached them. Carnation approached the family, and what happened is the deal went to pet milk, and these girls were featured in tons of advertisements. It said that the doctor who delivered them was their manager, and their mother apparently could not read or write, and the father was a sharecropper, so they pretty much made lots of money. As a matter of fact, it was said that the year that they first were advertised by this company was the most profitable year of the company ever. However, the girls did not get their fair share of the profits, because during this time, again, these young ladies, I believe they were born in the 40s, and it was a different time. And especially if you could not read or write, you certainly couldn't sign a contract. You could sign it, but you sure couldn't read it. So, you know, this was just how things were back then for black people, especially if you were not educated. Another instance of exploitation is in the case of twins, is these two brothers. They were exploited for years as they toured the country in sideshows. Their pale skin and their long dreadlocks, they were albino brothers, by the way, inspired circus promoters to give them racially tinged names, such as the Ecuadorian savages, sheep-headed cannibals, ambassadors from Mars, and the wild boys from Borneo. Now, the interesting thing about this is there's two versions of the story. One said that they were actually kidnapped and taken into the circus, and then the other version is that they were sold. So choose one. But the brothers rarely talked about that life. In 1971, George passed away due to unknown circumstances, and then Willie died in 2001, and he lived to be 108 years old, but he very rarely talked about that time in his life, because he said that he was just sick of it, and he was sick of people looking at him and asking him questions. And I could imagine what a horrible way to grow up, being in a sideshow when this is not something that you chose. And thus was the case. How many of you know the story of Uncle Ben's, the rice, which is still quite popular today? Well, the name Uncle Ben referred to a white Gulf Coast rice farmer. Surprise, surprise. And he was known only by Ben, and he delivered to food buyers a high-quality rice in the 1940s. Now, the man on the packages in the box was a maitre d' at a hotel, at an unknown Chicago restaurant in the mid-50s named Frank Brown. And the German-born scientist, Eric Husenlob, is the one who allegedly chose Ben's rice as the starting point for his revolutionary rice company. It is believed that the only reason Uncle Ben was called Uncle instead of Mr. Ben is because people, white people at the time, did not want to address blacks as Sir or Mr. And therefore, out of respect for his age, he was called Uncle. So this brother, he was working at a restaurant. This man who finally made the product, and he was looking for a name for the product and also an image to associate with the brand. And he saw this this black man working, and obviously he was, you know, in a suit and tie. He was the maitre d' at a restaurant at a hotel, and he put him on the box. So that's the story of Uncle Ben. Uncle Ben was never black, and he still isn't. And it's just an image. It's marketing. But I have to tell you, of the rice out there, I don't do starch too much now in my old age, but when I did, I always bought Uncle Ben's. It was a good rice, from what I recall. In fact, I preferred it over Carolina and quite a few of those other rice. I believe it was the long grain that got me. So this is not a promotion, by the way, because I don't know what it tastes like now, but this was back in the day when I used to live on rice. Okay, Richard Allen. He was born a slave in February 14th of 1764, and he was an African-American clergyman and founder of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. So those of you who attend these AME churches, please know, you probably do know, but for those of you who don't know, this was the man who founded it. He was the first pastor of a black group that withdrew from the Methodist Episcopal Church. And when the AME Church was organized, Richard Allen was then consecrated as its bishop. There's a term that's going around quite a bit for the last couple of years, Black Wall Street. But many people do not know that there actually was a place. And on June 1st, 1921, this photo shows you the scene in the Greenwood District where the wealthiest African-American community that ever was, and still to this date, in the United States, was completely destroyed during the Tulsa race riot. Now, Black Wall Street was a modern, majestic, sophisticated, and unapologetically black community. Tragically, it was also the site of this bloody, one of the bloodiest and most horrendous race riots and acts of terrorism that the United States have ever experienced. I think it left 300 people dead and more than 9,000 homeless. It was attacked, looted, and literally burned to the ground. And it said that this was strictly jealousy. This was in the early 1900s, and the whites of that town were very upset that blacks were prospering, and so it was pure jealousy. And it's a shame, but it is what it is. And it's now almost 100 years later, and not quite, but almost. And many people, especially black people, don't even know that this place existed. Then we have this, which is always amusing to me whenever I pay my Con Edison bill. I pay it online, and I always wish they had a comment box so I could remind them that Edison didn't create the bulb. But since they don't have a comment box, I can never tell them how I feel. Thomas Edison did not invent the light bulb. The inventor, Louis Latimer, of the filament, should be actually credited for what we now have as the light bulb, because without the filament, the bulb couldn't work. So from reading Latimer's story a couple of years ago, I did read his story because it intrigued me, and I understand that he was credited with several patents. He was a smart man, and again, I'm stressing education, and it doesn't mean necessarily that you have to go to college, but you, at the very least, should know how to read and know how to write. And if you're going to go into business, you should learn how to handle your business. And so this brother, Latimer, he knew how to handle his business. He applied for several copyrights, and he owned his inventions, unlike other people. But somehow, Edison still was able to take credit for the light bulb, and to this day, our light bill is paid through Con Edison, at least here in New York. Some of you might have other lighting companies. I understand that now there are actually quite a few other electric companies, but here in New York, we pay ours to Con Edison. And actually, how fitting is that? Because he probably conned Lattimore out of obtaining the copyright for the whole creation, and so he slapped his name on it. So yeah, Con Edison, that fits. Now I get it. All right, so what does the word have to say? So many of you youngins think you have created something new. You think that these trends and all this stuff you're doing is new and that it's never been done before. Well, guess what? Ecclesiastes 1, 9 through 10 says, all things continue the way they have been since the beginning. What has happened will happen again. There is nothing new here on earth. Someone might say, look, this is new. But really, it has always been here. It was here before we were. And that brings me to the second part of the video, whereas I want to show you some things that some people think are new, but they're actually things that have been done before, starting with tennis. Now, this is a 117-year gap. In the first photo, portrait A, is of Julia Richardson. She was a tennis player in 1898. She won 6 doubles titles during her career. To the right, portrait B, is Serena Williams, also a tennis player, 2015. And to the present, I believe she still plays, but she won 13 Grand Slam doubles titles during her career and more. Now, the interesting thing about this is the sister to the left is sitting in a crown, and she's very regal, and she's dressed very modestly, as I would imagine a queen would want to appear publicly, very modestly dressed. Yet, 117 years later, we have this queen of tennis, Serena, with her legs gapped open and in her spiky heels, in her sexy outfit, sitting on a throne. So, I'm not sure if Serena saw the picture of Julia Richardson and decided to do her own version, but it's nothing new. That's my point with that. I have more that I could say, but I won't because I want to keep going. Okay, brothers, there's so many of you out there that want to be gangsters. Well, here's a real gangster. This is Robert Smalls. Now, Brother Smalls, he was born into slavery. Okay, this also should show you and tell you that nothing can stop you if you're determined to reach your goal. He stole a Confederate military ship in 1862. So he was born in slavery in 1839. And then he stole this military ship in 1862. He disguised himself as the captain. He outwitted and got past these Confederate guard ships by using their secret codes and hand signs. He rescued slaves and their families, escaped to freedom, ran for Congress and he won. So if you heard that noise, I was so excited. I started banging on my table for emphasis, and it caused some of my stuff to fall down. So that's the noise you heard. Because some of you will give me messages about everything except the video. So I find that if I talk too much, it's because I have to stop and explain every little thing. Not all of you. Most of you are great. And even the ones who have to pick out and nitpick. I don't know how many times I've been told that it was not, it was Jet Li in the Aaliyah movie and not Jackie Chan. Okay, I made a mistake. Get over it. Moving on. Another thing some of you youngins think you started was the selfie. Now, I'm not sure if I got the sister's name right, but the picture is obviously her in a mirror with a camera taking her selfie. So selfies are not new, folks. This sister was doing it way, and from the attire that she has on, I would guess this was probably maybe the 40s or the 50s, maybe even the 60s. That camera looks old as heck. So who knows? But you didn't start it. Another thing that you youngins want to take credit for is twerking. And as you can see here, this is around the early 1900s based on the cars in the background. We have black people twerking in the street. They're twerking, and this is not something new. So you think it's new. And actually, I'm African. I can tell you that there are dances in Africa that look very similar to twerking. And so, you know, twerking is not new. For those of you, if you didn't have a clue, well, now you know. Okay, the other thing is the Afro. Now, many of you do know that the Afro is not new. It was actually popular in the 60s and the 70s, and this was thanks to Brother James Brown, who said, "Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud," and people began to embrace our blackness. But a lot of people of you don't know about this guy, Nate. He was called the Bush Doctor, and he opened his first hair shop in 1963 at the age of 23, and he called it Nat's Hair Care Clinic. And it was originally nicknamed the Hair Doctor, but once the Afro made its debut, he focused on treating the fro, and not just styling it. He focused on the care and the growth and so forth, and so he became known as the Bush Doctor. You go, Nat. That's a great thing. He was probably one of the first hair care specialists. The weave. A lot of you think that the weave is just from recent years. No. This sister, Krista Mae Thomas, was born Christmas Day in 1920. And they're conflicting the dates regarding her day of birth, but it was around the 20s, the 1920s. She was born in Louisiana. And the details of her early life are not really known. But what is known is that she graduated from Leland College near Baton Rouge with a degree in science in 1943. Jenkins started work at a wig manufacturer in Chicago, and in 1949 she began working on a technique to make a more secure-fitting wig. She then moved to Malvern, Ohio, and began studying how sewing in commercial hair with a person's natural hair could add length and body. And in 1951, Jenkins filed a patent for her hair weave technique, and that was granted in 1952. Jenkins owned and operated her Christina's Hair Weave Penthouse Salon in the Shaker Heights section of Cleveland until 1993. She also taught her hair weaving techniques at hair shows across Europe, and she later was married to jazz pianist Herman Duke Jenkins, and they raised one daughter together, Miss Sheila Jenkins Cochran. And so she was born Thomas, but she became Jenkins after she got married. So how about that? As so many of you think that these things are new. And I can even tell you something just off the record. It doesn't pertain to African Americans, but it does pertain to hair. A lot of people think that all these lace fronts and full lace wigs are new. But no, they had those things way back. I remember seeing a sister wearing one way back. It must have been in, it was around the time my daughter was born, so it had to be around 1970 something, maybe 78, 79. And the reason I could tell is because back then, the lace fronts, they were made by costume designers, people in theater, because they were used for shows. Like if you had someone who had to play a lion, if you remember that, the Wizard of Oz, they had wigs that they made to look like a lion's mane, and they would attach it to the person. And so this sister was wearing one, and I forgot, because it was so long ago, where she told me she had gotten it, but it was indeed a lace front wig. And so those, you know, they've been with us a while. That's a long time ago. Okay, so what has happened, people? Five types of minds after slavery currently exist. And that's the revolutionary. There is also the misguided. Then there's the self-hating. And then there is the ignorant to the culture and its struggles. And then there is, lastly, the whatever's convenient. I strongly, strongly urge you, brothers and sisters, if you fit into any of these particular categories, there's a few more that I could think of, but these are the main ones, you need to work on you. Because, yes, there's good things in some of these. In the revolutionary, you want to fight for change. You want to see change happen. That is all well and good. But we also have to be mindful that it's not a we against them scenario. Because right now, black people, we are responsible for we. We can't blame anybody else in this day and age. In this current 21st century, it is we who have to answer for ourselves. So the revolution has to begin within, in revolutionizing your thoughts and your actions, and then you can move on. Those of you who are misguided, unfortunately, the misguided rarely know that they're misguided. They think, and the Bible speaks of this too, they think that what they're doing is right in their own eyes. So that's the hardest group to reach, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't try. Also, the self-hating, whatever it is, however long ago it was, that whatever happened put you in that frame of mind, it's time to let it go. Some people go to their grave hating themselves, and the self-hating is actually how certain trends became popular. Wasn't always the reason, but these current trends that we have with the skin lightening and the fake hair, like I said, not everybody wears fake hair because they hate themselves, but there are a lot of people who do, and you can't deny it. They hate their kinky hair, and they don't want to see it, so they cover it with the hair that they want. And now we live in a time when you can pretty much be whatever you want to be. There's plastic surgeries, all these things are a direct result, in most cases, of self-hate. So you have to work on that. That, again, begins from within. Those who are ignorant to the culture and the struggles, I mentioned this in another video, there are many blacks who haven't struggled and who grew up in a different environment other than a black community. And so they don't sympathize, nor do they emphasize with the struggle. And because of that, they're far removed from it. They don't feel like they need to participate or delegate or, do anything for the furtherance and the betterment of black society, because they actually do not feel that they belong to it, although they are black. And lastly, you have these whatever's convenient, people that just want to live their life, and if they're okay and their family's okay, well, that's pretty much all they care about. So, people, step it up. And then I want to just close with saying, you know, blacks were the first blondes way before Clairol. I'm talking about naturally blonde. And this is just a small segment of black people who are around the world in different areas of the globe. And they are black-skinned people, but they may not necessarily be African. A lot of them are from different tribes, aboriginal tribes. You've got some from the Maltese Islands. You've got a lot of them from different places, but they still have the black skin color, and they were born with naturally blonde hair. So do not assume the next time you see a black person with blonde hair that they dyed it, because in a lot of cases, nope, we're born that way. Okay, so I'm going to wind it up now. There's a little more I'm going to show you after the prayer, but I'm not going to talk because I usually like the prayer to be the last thing that I say. So, but stay tuned because I want you to just see the message at the end that I thought was very appropriate for this video. So it's just another slide, a short one. But Lord, a lot of us are ignorant of who we are, where we came from, how we should proceed, what we should teach our children. There's just a lot of ignorance in terms of people not knowing the culture. And I believe, Lord, that if we don't know where we came from, we can't know where we're going. I think, Lord, and I ask you to please keep me clear on this, because I want to go out and speak with the youth, but I want to speak with knowledge. So, Lord, help me to understand that the reasoning behind so many young people in their choices that they're making these days, in their choices of being on the internet to find sex, instead of focusing on their skills and using the internet to gain knowledge and to further their education, help me to understand the young people who invest their entire day in playing video games instead of maybe learning how to create a video game and make it marketable. And become successful at that instead of being in a fantasy where once the game is over, so is that fantasy life. Help me to understand the young people and how and why they choose the gang lifestyle, Lord, as opposed to being independent and following their own mind and being real gangsters by making change and helping and uplifting people, and Lord, there's just so much lacking still in our people. As a black woman, Lord, I ask you to help me to understand, what do I need to do to change the course of the youth, in particular the black youth? I'm very, very, very concerned. So, Lord, I ask your guidance in these things. I ask you to bless the listener, bless those who are blessed by the video. And I thank you. I thank you.
I am the proud father of two beautiful children, Elijah, 15, and Octavia, 12. When Elijah was in the fourth grade, he came to me, came home from school, bubbling over with excitement about what he had learned that day about African-American history. Now, I'm an African-American cultural studies professor, and so as you can imagine, African-American culture is kind of serious around my home, so I was very proud that my son was excited about what he had learned that day in school. So I said, well, what'd you learn? He said, I learned about Rosa Parks. I said, okay, what did you learn about Rosa Parks? He said, I learned that Rosa Parks was this frail old black woman in the 1950s in Montgomery, Alabama, and she sat down on this bus, and she had tired feet, and when the bus driver told her to give up her seat to a white patron, she refused because she had tired feet, and it had been a long day, and she was tired of oppression. And she didn't give up her seat. And she marched with Martin Luther King, and she believed in nonviolence. And I guess he must have looked at my face and saw that I was a little less than impressed by his history lesson. And so he stopped, and he's like, Dad, what's wrong? What did I get wrong? I said, son, you didn't get anything wrong, but I think your teacher got a whole lot of things wrong. He said, well, what do you mean? I said, Rosa Parks was not tired. She was not old, and she certainly didn't have tired feet. He said, what? I said, yes. Rosa Parks was only 42 years old. Yeah, you're shocked, right? Never heard that. Rosa Parks was only 42 years old. She had only worked 6 hours that day, and she was a seamstress, and her feet were just fine. The only thing that she was tired of was she was tired of inequality. She was tired of oppression. And my son said, well, why would my teacher, you know, tell me this thing? You know, this is confusing for me, because he loved his teacher, and she was a good teacher, a youngish, you know, 20-something white woman, really, really smart, pushed him, so I liked her as well. But he was confused. Why would she tell me this, he said. He said, Dad, tell me more. Tell me more. Tell me more about Rosa Parks. And I said, son, I'll do you one better. He was like, what? I said, I'm going to buy her autobiography, and I'm going to let you read it yourself. So as you can imagine, Elijah wasn't too excited about this new lengthy homework assignment that his dad had just given him, but he took it in stride, and he came back after he had read it, and he was excited about what he had learned. He said, Dad, he said, not only was Rosa Parks not initially into nonviolence, she said, but Rosa Parks' grandfather, who basically raised her and was light enough to pass as white, used to walk around town with his gun in his holster, and people knew that if you mess with Mr. Parks' children or grandchildren, he would put a cap in your proverbial bottom, right? He was not someone to mess with. And he said, I also learned that Rosa Parks married a man in Raymond who was a lot like her grandfather, right? He would organize. He was a civil rights activist. He would organize events, and sometimes the events would be at Rosa Parks' home. And one time Rosa Parks remarked that there were so many guns on the table because they were prepared for somebody to come busting into the door, that they were prepared for whatever was going to go down. That Rosa Parks said there were so many guns on the table that I forgot to even offer them coffee or food. Right. This is who Rosa Parks was. And in fact, Rosa Parks, when she was sitting on that bus that day, waiting for those police officers to arrive and not knowing what was going to happen to her, she was not thinking about Martin Luther King, who she barely knew. She was not thinking about nonviolence or Gandhi. She was thinking about her grandfather, her gun-toting, take-no-mess grandfather. That's who Rosa Parks was thinking about. And my son was mesmerized by Rosa Parks. And I was proud of him to see this excitement. But then I still had a problem because I still had to go to his school and address the issue with his teacher because I didn't want her to continue to teach the kids, obviously, false history. So I'm agonizing over this primarily because I understand as an African-American man that whenever you talk to whites about racism or anything that's racially sensitive, there's usually going to be a challenge. This is what white sociologist Robin DiAngelo calls white fragility. She argues that, in fact, because whites have so little experience being challenged about their white privilege, that whenever even the most minute challenge is brought before them, they usually cry, get angry, or run. And I have experienced them all. And so when I was contemplating confronting his teacher, I wasn't happy about it, but I was like, this is a necessary evil of being a black parent trying to raise self-actualized black children. So I called Elijah to me, and I said, Elijah, I'm going to tell your teacher, you know, I'm going to set up an appointment with your teacher and try and correct this and maybe your principal. What do you think? And Elijah said, Dad, I have a better idea. And I said, really, what's your idea? He said, we have a public speaking assignment, and why don't I use that public speaking assignment to talk about debunking the myths of Rosa Parks? And I was like, well, that is a good idea. So Elijah goes to school, he does his presentation, he comes back home, and I can see something positive happen. I said, well, what happened, son? He said, well, later on in that day, the teacher pulled me aside, and she apologized to me for giving that misinformation. And then something else miraculous happened the next day. She actually taught a new lesson on Rosa Parks, filling in the gaps that she had left and correcting the mistakes that she made. And I was so, so proud of my son. But then I thought about it, and I got angry. And I got real angry. Why? Why would I get angry? Because my 9-year-old son had to educate his teacher about his history, had to educate his teacher about his own humanity. He's 9 years old. He should be thinking about basketball or soccer or, right, the latest movie. He should not be thinking about having to take the responsibility of educating his teacher, his students, right, about himself, about his history. That was a burden that I carried. That was a burden that my parents carried and generations before them carried. And now I was seeing my son take on that burden too. You see, that's why Rosa Parks wrote her autobiography. Because during her lifetime, if you can imagine, you do this amazing thing. You're alive and you're talking about this, your civil rights activism, and a story emerges in which somebody is telling the world that you were old and you had tired feet and you just were an accidental activist. Not that you had been an activist by then for 20 years. Not that the boycott had been planned for months. Not that you were not even the first or the second or even the third woman to be arrested for doing that. Right? You become an accidental activist, even in her own lifetime. So she wrote that autobiography to correct the record, because what she wanted to remind people of was that this is what it was like in the 1950s, trying to be black in America and fight for your rights. During the year, a little over a year that the boycott lasted, there were over 4 church bombings. Martin Luther King's house was bombed twice. Other civil rights leaders' houses were bombed in Birmingham. Rosa Parks' husband slept at night with a shotgun because they would get constant death threats. In fact, Rosa Parks' mother lived with them, and sometimes she would stay on the phone for hours so that nobody would call in with death threats because it was constant and persistent. In fact, there was so much tension, there was so much pressure, there was so much terrorism that Rosa Parks and her husband, they lost their jobs and they became unemployable and eventually had to leave and move out of the South. This is a civil rights reality that Rosa Parks wanted to make sure that people understood. So you say, well, David, what does that have to do with me? I'm a well-meaning person. I didn't own slaves. You know, I'm not trying to whitewash history. I'm a good guy. I'm a good person. Let me tell you what it has to do with you, and I'll tell it to you by telling you a story about a professor of mine, white professor, when I was in graduate school, who was brilliant, brilliant individual. We'll call him Fred. And Fred was writing this history of the civil rights movement, but he was writing specifically about a moment that happened to him in North Carolina when this white man shot this black man in cold blood in a wide open space and was never convicted. And so it was this great book, and he called together a couple of his professor friends, and he called me to read a draft of it before final submission. And I was flattered that he called me. I was only a graduate student then, and I was kind of feeling myself a little bit. I was like, okay, I'm sitting around amongst intellectuals, and I read the draft of the book. And there's a moment in the book that struck me as being deeply problematic. And so I said, Fred, as we were sitting around talking about this draft, I said, Fred, I got a real problem with this moment that you talk about your maid in your book. And he said, I could see Fred get a little, got a little up, he's got a little tight, as we say. And he said, what do you mean? That's a great story. It happened just like I said. I said, can I give you another scenario? Now, what's the story? It was 1968. Martin Luther King had just been assassinated. His maid, domestic, we'll call her Maybelle, was in the kitchen. Little Fred is 8 years old. Little Fred comes into the kitchen. And Maybelle, who he's only seen as smiling and helpful and happy, is bent over the sink, and she's crying. And she's sobbing inconsolably. And little Fred comes over to her and says, Maybelle, what is wrong? And Maybelle turns and she says, they killed him. They killed our leader. They killed Martin Luther King. He's dead. They are monsters. And little Fred says, it'll be okay, Maybelle. It'll be okay. It'll be okay. And she looked at him. She says, no, it's not going to be okay. Did you not hear what I just said? They killed Martin Luther King. And Fred, son of a preacher, he looks up at Maybelle and he says, but Maybelle, didn't Jesus die on the cross for our sins? Wasn't that a good outcome? Maybe this will be a good outcome. Maybe the death of Martin Luther King will lead to a good outcome. And as Fred tells the story, he says that Maybelle put her hand over her mouth. She reached down and she gave little Fred a hug. And then she reached into the icebox and took out a couple Pepsis, gave him some Pepsis, and sent him on his way to play with his siblings. And he said, this was proof that even in the most harrowing times of race struggle, that two people could come together across racial lines and find human commonality along the lines of love and affection. And I said, Fred, that is some BS. Fred was like, what? But I don't understand, David. That's the story. I said, Fred, let me ask you a question. I said, you were in North Carolina, 1968. If Maybelle would have went to her community, you were 8 years old, what do you think the 8-year-old African-American children were calling her? Do you think they were calling her by her first name? No, they called her Miss Maybelle, or they called her Miss Johnson, or they called her Auntie Johnson. They would have never dared call her by her first name, because that would have been the height of disrespect. And yet you were calling her by her first name every single day that she worked, and you never thought about it. I said, let me ask you another question. Was Maybelle married? Did she have children? What church did she go to? What was her favorite dessert? Fred could not answer any of those questions. I said, Fred, this story is not about Maybelle. This story is about you. I said, this story made you feel good, but this story is not about Maybelle. The reality is, what probably happened was Maybelle was crying, which was not something she customarily did. So she was letting her guard down. And you came into the kitchen, and you caught her at a weak moment where she was letting her guard down. And see, because you thought of yourself as just like one of her children, you didn't recognize that you were, in fact, the child of her employer. And she found herself yelling at you. And then she caught herself realizing that if I'm yelling at him and he goes back and he tells his dad or he tells mom, I could lose my job. And so she tempered herself. And she ended up, even though she needed consoling, she ended up consoling you and sending you on your way, perhaps so she could finish mourning in peace. And Fred was stunned. And he realized that he had actually misread that moment. And see, this is what they did to Rosa Parks, because it's a lot easier to digest an old grandmother with tired feet who doesn't stand up because she wants to fight for inequality, but because her feet and her back are tired and she's worked all day. See, grandmothers, old grandmothers are not scary, but young, radical black women who don't take any stuff from anybody are very scary, who stand up to power and are willing to die for that. Those are not the kind of people that make us comfortable. So you say, what do you want me to do, David? I don't know what to do. Well, what I would say to you is there was a time in which if you were Jewish, you were not white. If you were Italian, you were not white. If you were Irish, you were not white in this country. It took a while before the Irish, the Jews, and the Italians became white, right? There was a time in which you were othered, when you were the people on the outside. Toni Morrison said, if in order for you to be tall, I have to be on my knees, you have a serious problem. She says, white America has a serious, serious problem. To be honest, I don't know if race relations will improve in America. But I know that if they will improve, we have to take these challenges on head on. The future of my children depend on it. The future of my children's children depends on it. And whether you know it or not, the future of your children and your children's children depends on it too. Thank you.
Okay, well, that's the end of the show. I hope you got something out of it. Think about some stuff. So I'm past my time. I'm about to go ahead and close this up and get on out of here. I may do another show next week, depending on what the schedule looks like. Just keep an eye out. I'll post it like I always do. Let you know the time. It'll probably be Monday, same time, same channel, same place. So I hope you got a lot out of this. And until next week, probably, I think I'll probably be able to do another one. So until next week, I will see you next Monday. Peace out. Stay black. Stay strong.